called a patriarch. It's no fun, really. He says, we're going to do this conference. You can come and speak. We're going to have three themes: patriarchs, prophets, and Pentecost. You get to be one of the old guys. I said, well, thank you, Chris. I hope you pay them more. I didn't say that. But it does make me feel old, and I'm planning, in not too distant future, to grow my hair long when it's all white, and have a ponytail and a long beard and wear a purple cape. Then we can really do a show. But I guess I have had a modicum of success. Some of you, I suspect, have suffered watching me on video. Who would fall into that category? I'm sorry about that. But at least you got to see the younger, thinner version of me. And I have been very enthusiastic and trying to be as involved as possible in the homeschool speech and debate world. One of my older children, now quite old, a mother of three, got going with it over a decade ago. We got started. In thinking about this talk, of course, in writing, communication, blogging, anything, it's all about audience, right? You have to think about your audience. That's the first thing you should think about before you think about anything else. So I was thinking about you contrasted to me. And of course, the word is youth, as opposed to age. You're young. As I started thinking about what it was like to be young, I had to muster up some ancient memories. The main thing I remember is how stupid I was when I was young, and how grateful I am that you are not as stupid as I was when I was your age. Because clearly you aren't, otherwise you wouldn't be here. You'd be off doing stupid things. But I've noticed the young people I work with and talk to and meet as I travel around the country and even the world, is there's three questions that are constantly nagging you. These are either conscious questions that you ask yourself intentionally, or subconscious questions that are always in the back of your mind. In fact, they direct a lot of your interaction with people and the things that you do and thoughts you think throughout the day. And these questions, I believe, are these three. Who am I? Why am I here? And what am I supposed to do with this life? Would you agree? Aren't those questions that are somewhere in your mind? Who am I, really? This is the great perennial problem of being 13 or 14. You have no clue. Now, most of you are a little past that. I know a girl who has on her wall a statement. Music is not what I do, it's who I am. This is a sign of searching for identity. And of course, we're always searching for identity. I'm still searching for identity. But I think it's particularly painful at your age. Who am I? Really? I remember being, I don't know, must have been at least 17, because I know I could drive, because I drove there. And I went to this movie. Hopefully, probably none of you have seen it because it's old and none of you like watching movies from the 80s. But it was Rollerball. This is where there's no more countries, there's just corporations, and there's no more wars, there's just Rollerball. And it's a gladiator thing to the death. And there's the one hero of Rollerball, Jonathan E., and he's the great hero of the greatest rollerball team in the world. And I remember coming out of that movie, imagining myself being like him. And thinking, I want to be that cool. I want to be Jonathan E., who can do the right thing and defeat all of the big, ugly, strong dudes. And still look good at the end of the movie. I remembered this just recently. I thought, this is one of the great cravings that we have in answering this question, who am I? And the question is, who do I want to be like? Who do I want to be like? We're always looking for role models. We can't not look for role models. We can't just kind of wake up in the morning and say, I don't want to be like anybody. I just want to be myself. You can try, but you can't do it. Why? Because we're wired for imitation. We're wired to look for something and want to take a part of that and bring it into ourselves and incarnate and bring it out through ourselves. This is the nature of being human, is to be an imitator. And so one of the big questions that you want to ask yourself after you say, who am I and who do I want to be, is who do I want to be like? And of course, we have great examples. We have great examples from history. We have great examples from Christian history. We have the martyrs. We have the saints. I also noticed that a lot of people kind of get obsessed with superheroes. Have you noticed this? For a while, I wondered, why is this fascination with superheroes? And then I realized it's because we all need those examples of superhero-ness to want to take into our soul so we can then incarnate and embody that. I also suspect that one of the things we've lost in Western culture, and in American Western culture in particular, is what was once called the cult of the saints. Because at one point, the superheroes were the saints, the people who sacrificed themselves to do the great things in Christian history. And having lost that to some degree, we've had to replace them with great people who do things and sacrifice themselves, but still come out looking good at the end. That has an even greater appeal than death to most of us. But this is a question I think you want to walk out of here and keep in your mind and say, well, who do I want to be like? Because you can't not be like anyone. You have to choose who you will imitate. You have to choose the character qualities that you will see in other people, take them into yourselves, and then represent those to the world. Even the greatest God-man that ever lived, Jesus Christ, was imitating whom? His Father. He was imitating perfection, incarnating, bringing into the flesh perfection so that we could see that, so that we could know more about the nature of God and what it's like to be perfect. And when you listen to the speech of kind of the rundown of what it is like to be, you know, what you have to do to be a really good Christian, and you think, I can't do that. I can't love my neighbor. I can barely love my sister. Right? Because she's so irritating some of the time. Right? And you think, I'm so far away from that ideal. Then what do we have to do? We have to go back and look for how do we do it through imitation. We can't do it by concept. We have to look for others who succeed. So that's the first question. Second question is, why am I here? Why am I here? How did it happen that I exist? Well, yeah, my parents got together and that was a big part of it. But why? It wasn't an accident. How many people think they came here by accident? If you did, you're in the wrong room. You know, get out and go join a bunch of atheists. Because God doesn't do accidents, and souls aren't created by accident. And it's got to be part of a bigger plan. But see, a lot of the world would like to convince you that you're an accident. You see, the whole Darwinist idea is that human beings are just evolving animals, and you just happen to be at the top of the totem pole right now. You just happen to be one of the smartest animals who is accidentally here on Earth, and what you do doesn't really matter. And that's a lie. And the world will push that lie at you in subtle ways. And you won't even notice it if you're not keeping the question in your mind. Why am I here? Well, if you believe that God created you, then you would believe that you are here for a purpose. Fair enough? So that leads then to the next question. What is the purpose? What am I supposed to do with my life? Because you have this whole life, and it may last a day, or it may last 100 years longer. It will come to an end, which is a painful thing, but important one to think about. But you have this life. So what are you going to do with it? This implies that you have something to do. How many people kind of think, the purpose of my life is just to survive? Some people, right? How do we just survive? Well, we just wake up in the morning and somehow don't die. You know, we get in a safe condition where we don't risk anything, and we don't really do anything terribly dangerous, and then we don't think any dangerous thoughts could lead us to think of. In fact, if we just watch TV all day, we'd be pretty safe from death. We'd also be very safe from life, because life is dangerous. It's meant to be. And if you have a mission, a purpose, a reason, then that's going to nag at you. It's going to nag at you. In fact, it's going to bother you. Every morning when you wake up, you're going to be thinking, who am I really? And why am I here? And what am I going to do with this life? And I don't want to think those thoughts. So I think I'll just go do something that prevent me from having to think of those thoughts. Right? Because they're scary, hard thoughts. But see, you're here because you're willing to think scary, hard thoughts. People who weren't willing to think scary, hard thoughts wouldn't come to a conference called For Action. Now, there's a book, I bet you, some of you have read this book, Do Hard Things, The Rebellion Against Teenage Mediocrity. Great book. I read it and I thought, I would like to write the book called Do Crazy Things. Only then I read James O'Keefe's book. He didn't call it Do Crazy Things. What did he call it? Breakthrough. But it should be called Doing Insanely Crazy Things. So I don't have to write the book because he already did all those crazy things. But I wanted to talk a little bit about why you may need to do some crazy things in your life in order to reach the point where you know what you're supposed to do. And so part of this is kind of my philosophy, and part of it is some of my personal experience. And that's all you can get from an old guy, right? No brilliant insights, mine too old. Just what happened, the story. Now, I think the problem is a paradox. And a paradox is when you have a seemingly unanswerable question, or one that would have two answers, although they might be contradictory. Here's the paradox that you have as I see it. If you believe you're here for a reason and you have a mission, but you don't know your mission, how do you prepare for it? How many of you who are under the age of 25 know your mission? You could say with a clear statement, this is what I am on earth for. All right, a couple. A lot of us, pretty fuzzy. I didn't know my mission till I was 35 years old. So there's a long time between being really stupid and then getting a little bit smarter and having lots of crazy things happen and then discovering the mission. The problem is, if you don't know your mission, but you feel like you have a mission, how do you prepare for it, right? So that's the paradox I think many of you have, is how do I prepare for what I don't know what's coming? Now, in a general sense, I think most of you would probably fall into kind of a traditional catechism response. You know, what is the chief end of man? Westminster Catechism, to glorify God and enjoy Him forever, right? That's pretty easy to say, a little hard to do, but pretty good answer, but it's not at all specific. The problem is you're all individuals. So you have, in addition to that large purpose, the specific thing, or many specific things, that God might need you to accomplish in this life. So I would like to go over a few areas that I think would help you prepare for a mission you may not know what it is. I would also like to mention a few impediments to those preparations that are likely to rear their ugly head, or already have, and interfere, perhaps, with the preparation, and maybe even with the mission itself, depending on how ugly and how serious they get for you. First thing is dividing us into our elements. We always think of humans as having a mental and a physical and a spiritual component, right? Mind, body, soul. And I would start with the mind. I would start with the mental preparation, because the things you think will determine pretty much everything else. In a way, you could say the thoughts you think will determine whether you have much of a spiritual life or not, right? Because if you wake up in the morning and say, you know, how can I go have a good time? That's different than if you wake up in the morning and say, God, what do you want me to do today? Right? But those are thoughts. Those are thoughts. I'm going to start with the mental. And I think one of the exciting things, I was just talking with, who was I talking with at dinner? Jonathan. He is a fascinating man. And we were having a great conversation about the nature of dialogue and questions and the importance of asking questions. One of the tricks I like to pull on teenagers, and maybe I've done this to you if you've ever seen me before, is I like to ask the question, how do you think? If someone says, think now, how do you make that happen? How do you turn it on? And a lot of people, quite honestly, say, I have no idea. Actually, non-thinking is pretty obvious. You see it quite frequently, especially in California around election time. Large majority of people just don't know how to think. They don't know the skill of it. Now, sometimes people will say stuff like, you use your brain. Okay, how do you use your brain? Well, you think of stuff. Occasionally, you get a cocky kid who'll say, how do you think? Logically, of course. But how do you do it? What's the mechanics of it? Right? This is an important thing. And what I have noticed is that people like you actually do very often figure this out. And one of the reasons you figure it out is if you do speech and debate at all, there's this thing called cross X. Right? Where you have to now stand up next to someone and do what? Ask a question. And you may not have a question to ask, but you are forced to ask one. And what you gradually notice over time is that thinking is really, essentially, a conversation, is it not? But it's a conversation with yourself. Right? Asking questions is the key to thinking. Not only that, the type of questions you ask will determine the quality of your life. So, if you wake up in the morning and say, ooh, how can I make some money today so I can get a new iPad? You'll have one quality of life. If you wake up in the morning and say, how can I grow in wisdom and virtue that I could better serve my family, God, and fellow man? You will have a different quality of life. Do you see it? You get to decide your life. You get to decide the quality of your life. You get to decide how happy you will be. I know that's a scary thought because it's so much more convenient to blame everything else if you're not happy. But it's the thoughts you have that determine that, isn't it? And the questions you ask determine the thoughts you have. So, you want to prepare yourself for your mission by learning to ask good questions. How do you do that? How do you learn anything? If you want to learn how to play basketball, what should you do? Hang out with people who do it, right? If you want to learn how to paint pictures, how do you do that? Hang out with people who paint pictures. If you want to learn how to ask good questions, hang out with people who ask good questions. It's simple. A little bit harder to find those people, but they are there. And this is why one of the most important possible questions you can ask yourself is, who should I hang out with? Now, when you're young, you're still at home, you don't have as much control over this, right? Some of you have very little control over this. My children, for example, have very little control over who they hang out with, right? I kind of like to micromanage their lives, as they will testify if you ask them, right? Only because I've learned from not controlling social relationships in a little bit better way, that can lead to bad things. That's happened to me in the past. But as you get older, guess what? You've got to start making those decisions. And pretty soon, you're going to launch yourself and go somewhere, and you will have to decide who to hang out with. That is possibly the most important thing that you can decide once you're out from under the control of your parents. So remember that idea. Now, there's two types of people you can hang out with. Living people and dead people. Isn't that true? Now, the living people, they're a little bit, you know, more random. The dead people, you have to go search for them. Where do you look for the dead people to hang out with? Not graves. Libraries, books. That's where you go. Although you could read a book in a graveyard if you want to. And contemplation of death is always a good thing for the soul, I will admit. But no, you can choose to hang out with dead people who had really great skill in asking questions. So the books you choose to read, in a way, are the second most significant thing you will decide in your life, right? Now, of course, many of you have been forced to read certain books, Right? I guess probably everyone in this room has been forced to read certain books, which you may or may not have liked. That was at the discretion of your parents or teachers who said it would be good for you to hang out with this person who wrote this book. And they're probably dead. And the advantage of a book is you can't argue with it. The disadvantage of a book is that you can't argue with it. The way to get around that is to just go ahead and argue with it. Right? Because you can read something and you don't have to agree with it. You can challenge it. And when you challenge what's in the book, what is that called? Thinking! Yes! Asking questions. And the best possible combination is to have a live person who knows how to ask good questions and a dead person who has lots of really interesting ideas. And then the live person can help you learn to ask questions about the dead person's ideas. That would be a mentor. You see? So you want to find people like that. You want to find great books. Because when you read a great book, it gets you in direct contact with a great mind. Right? That's why it's a great book. If it was written by a stupid person, nobody would be reading it. Right? But if it's been around for 100 years or 1,000 years, right? Well, then it's got value other people have attested to. You have a little more confidence. Right? So you read great books so you can get in direct contact with a great mind, and you hang out with great people who can help you ask intelligent questions about great books, because guess what? Not all great books are good. Very few great books are absolutely good, and some great books are flat out evil. Right? Because not all great minds are good. Some great minds are flat out evil. So you have to be able to ask the right questions to discern, which is another word for a word you don't like, and that's judge. What's the motto of the millennials? Don't judge me. But you have to judge. You have to judge everything. If you didn't judge things, then you wouldn't be able to discern truth from lie, would you? You have to make judgments. And the painful other side of that is you have to be willing to let your decisions be judged as well. And that takes all sorts of ugly things like humility, obedience, but we won't go there. We'll stay on topic and get to the next thing, mental preparation. First was questions. First was being able to ask good questions. That's the skill. That's what you need. Second, mental preparation. You must understand the times. Now, it's interesting because everybody's always been complaining about the times. Have you noticed that? There's ancient Latin saying, "Oh, the times, oh, the morals." Guess who said this? Times are bad. The currency is debased, parents do not respect their children, and everyone is writing a book. Cicero, 55 AD. Right? So nothing's changed, there's nothing new under the sun. Parents have always been irritated. You will be irritated when you are a parent, right? But there's also ways in which times differ. There are cycles. And I think one great thing that you can study and learn from a good study of history is cycles. Because while everything stays the same, it also changes and comes back around. And I've spent quite a bit of time over the past decade or so reading about different cycles. In fact, the most exciting present I got for Christmas from one of my daughters was a book about pendulum. It's called Pendulum. It's about how we swing between these 40-year cycles of me and we. Fascinating book. In the me period, it's all about me. Individualism, creativity, initiative, ambition, conquer the world. In the we cycle, it's all about us and community and relationship and sharing and building together. Both are important, aren't they? What happens when you take one to an extreme? It's all about me, you suck. Right? It's all about me. I'm going to rule. I'm going to have power. It's going to be chaos. Right? What happens when it's all about we? Collectivism, communism. There is no me. Let us all just share everything. And so what happens then is we swing between these cycles, right? And so where do you think we are right now, according to this book? I mean, what would you guess? As the brief little description I gave you, where would you think we're headed towards?
We.
Yeah, the we. So we came off the me of the 60s and 70s. Actually, we're coming up to the me in the 60s, hit the point right around the 80s, and it was Enron and fraud and corruption and all about me. And now we're on the downswing, right? And we're past the middle point, which looks similar both ways, and we're on the upswing to the we. Now, this book's all about marketing and how do you capitalize on knowing what people are thinking. Okay, you can go do that if you want to. If you're blogging, use we more than I, right? If you're trying to persuade people, use the collective third-person plural pronoun, right? Because it's all about us. We're in this together. We have got to cooperate and do things.
We've got this.
Yes, we do. We've got it.
Yes.
Praise the Lord. And that's the mentality. Now, the danger is we go into full-out communism, right? Full-out, it's all about collectivism, and we lose, what do we lose? Individuality, initiative, creativity, those things start to die. So anyway, fascinating book, you read if you want to. Another book I highly recommend is The Fourth Turning. This theory is basically that we go in 25 or so year cycles, 25 to 50 year cycles, and he calls these, I'll tell you the truth, you do not have to buy the book. You can get all the information that's in the book worth reading from the website. So just fourthturning.com, I think, is what it is. And he talks about how we go through these cycles, and the first cycle has to do with the high. This is where everything is alive, and you're working for a cause, and you achieve the cause. The American Revolution, that was a high, right? The awakening is the second turning, and this is where everybody kind of has this high energy and they start to see and create, and they're far enough away from crisis and on both sides that they can really be excited and do things, and there's a boom of art and philosophy and music and culture. And then the third turning then is what he calls the unraveling. This is when things start to fall apart a little bit. Discipline, chaos starts to appear. Basic principles start to be lost. And then there's the fourth turning, which is crisis. So the period between the American Revolution and this American Civil War, it was about 100 years, had all four of these turnings, right? The high, and then the awakening, and then you saw the unraveling, and then the crisis of the war. And then out of the war came the new cycle. So in any case, in his view, we're at the end of unraveling and the beginning of crisis. In some ways, you can even say that the symptoms of the last 10 years, the basic economic stability could be falling apart. So that's the fourth turn. You can take it or leave it. But it's interesting to study because it causes you to think, where in history am I? Now, the other one I wanted to bring to your attention is called the Titler cycle, or sometimes called the fatal cycle. T-Y-T-L-E-R, he was an 1800s political philosopher, historian. Much of his work was destroyed in a fire. But he had this theory, that there's kind of this cycle that civilizations, nations, empires all go through. And if you could start anywhere on it, if you want to, but if you start at the bottom, it's tyranny and oppression. Now, tyranny and oppression causes an interesting side effect, which is a rebirth of faith. Because when you have nothing, you have to believe in something. And so you often see it's times of tyranny and oppression where there's rebirths of faith. Now, faith will generally cause you to fight for something. Because if you believe in it, you're willing to risk for it. So we look at our, say, founding fathers of this country who said, I will risk my life, my liberty, my all, for this ideal of freedom. So faith, if it doesn't kill you, can result in freedom. Now, freedom is the natural condition of man. So it brings prosperity. So man, in a free society, will be most prosperous. Now you're at the top, right? Now, prosperity is an interesting condition because it brings the unwanted side effect of abundance. The reason that's dangerous is because abundance is a condition of having more than you need. What happens when you have more than you need? you become complacent or apathetic. And this is why, by the way, and I would counsel you, young people, this is why the law of the tithe is so critical to your personal and communal abundance. Because if you don't give away that which you do not need, you cannot remain in prosperity. The law of the tithe has its spiritual component, but it has a realistic, meaningful component, which is if you can give away more than you need, you can remain prosperous. But if you hold on to it, then you will fall into complacency. Complacency has the unwanted side effect of dependency, and dependency always leads to what?
Tyranny
and oppression. So if someone can make you dependent on them, they now get to control you, correct? So the question, of course, is where are we in this country or this Western civilization cycle, wherever you want to put it, where are we here? Where would you say?